Hello, and welcome to the Murderosity Podcast, where we discuss all things murder, mayhem, the mysterious, and the macabre. I'm your co-host, Bob Hancock, joined on the other side by Rebel Roan. Rebel, how are you doing this week?
Doing pretty good. How are you?
You know, I'm doing excellent, actually. It's weather's turning pretty nice here, and we have one heck of a case this week.
Yes, we do.
So, where are you going to take me this week, Rebel?
So this week's case takes us to San Diego, California, where we take a look at the brutal case of Mark Anthony Gator Rogowski. A shout out to Tina Cook for recommending this case several months ago.
Yes. So, dear listeners, we do have quite the backlog of requested episodes. So if you have sent us something and are waiting for it, be patient. We do tend to move a lot of our requests to the front of the line. So it's coming. But thank you very much, Tina. And you brought up San Diego, California. That's where this takes place. Now, if you live in the States, you know San Diego, but we have international listeners. So San Diego is actually a city on the Pacific Ocean coast in Southern California. It's located immediately adjacent to the Mexico-United States border. And with a population of 1.3 million residents, the city is actually the eighth most populous city in the U.S. and the second most populous in the state of California after Los Angeles. The city is the seat of San Diego County, which has a population of nearly 3.3 million people as of the 2021 census. And San Diego is known for its mild year-round Mediterranean climate, extensive beaches and parks, and its long association with the United States Navy and Marine Corps. Its recent emergence as a healthcare and biotechnology development center has kind of been meteoric. So historically, it was home to the Kumeyaay Native American tribe, and San Diego has been referred to actually as the birthplace of California. This is because it was the first site visited and settled by Europeans on what is now the west coast of the U.S. Now, upon landing in San Diego Bay in 1542, Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo claimed the area for Spain, and it formed the basis for the settlement of Alta California 200 years later. Now, the Presidio and the Mission San Diego Alcala was founded in 1769, and it actually formed the first European settlement in what is now California. In 1821, San Diego became part of the newly declared Mexican Empire when it broke away from Spain and was reformed as the first Mexican Republic 2 years later. California was actually conquered by the United States in 1848 following the Mexican-American War, and California was admitted into the Union as a state in 1850. California also famously sided with the northern states during the American Civil War. Now, San Diego's main economic engines are military and defense-related activities, tourism, international trade, research, and manufacturing. The city is the economic center of the San Diego-Tijuana Conurbation, which is the second most populous trans-border metropolitan area in the Western Hemisphere right after Detroit-Windsor, and it's home to an estimated 4.9 million people as of 2012. The primary border crossing between San Diego and Tijuana, the San Ysidro port of entry, is the busiest international land border crossing in the world outside of Asia, and it's actually the fourth busiest overall. And interestingly enough, the city's airport, San Diego International, is the busiest single runway airport in the world. So I'm pretty sure none of that is why you have brought me to San Diego, but you did mention Mark Anthony Gator Rogowski. What can you tell me about him?
So, born on August 10th, 1966, Mark Anthony Gator Rogowski is an American former professional skateboarder who was convicted of murder. He was prominent in the 1980s and early 1990s. His career was cut short when he pled guilty of assaulting, raping, and murdering Jessica Bergston in 1991. Rogowski was born in Brooklyn, New York, but he moved to Escondido, California at the age of three following his parents' divorce. A gifted athlete, he played Little League baseball in his youth. He started to skateboard at the age of seven, and while most of his friends were into surfing, he eventually started to hang out at skate parks several years later. In 1978, after 2 years of skating at local parks, he was picked up by a local skate team at only 12 years of age. He began his professional skateboarding career in 1980 at age 14. In 1982, he won his first major contest, the Canadian Amateur Skateboarding Championships in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. In 1984, he won a national championship. He received endorsement deals from Gullwing Trucks and GNS early in his career. He was the first skateboarder to receive his own Prodec by Vision Sports, and his Prodec proved popular and was soon followed by the Mark Gonzalez and Tom Grucholsky models. Rogowski was soon featured on the cover of Thrasher magazine for the first time in June 1984, and he would go on to be featured on the cover of Trans World Skateboarding in October 1985. He was featured on the covers of both magazines again in July and October 1987 as well. At the height of his fame, he was being paid between $4,000 and $8,000 a month for clothing and skateboarding equipment endorsements. By 1987, Rogowski was earning $2 per skate deck from Vision, which was selling 7,000 decks on a monthly basis, resulting in royalties totaling $14,000, about $36,000 in today's money. Additionally, Vision was also selling t-shirts, berets, hip packs, and stickers using the Gator name.
All right, so what you're talking about there is corporate sponsorship. Now, a corporate sponsorship is a form of marketing in which a company pays for the right to be associated with a project or program or athlete or individual. A common template for corporate sponsorships entails a collaboration between an organization and a sponsor organization, in which the latter funds a project or program managed by the former in exchange for recognition. Now, these can be nonprofits, these can be athletes. Corporations also may have their logos and brand names displayed alongside of the organization undertaking the project or program, with specific mention that the corporation has provided funding. It's not the same as like philanthropy, which involves donations to causes that serve the public good that may not yield any return branding or otherwise to the donor. Corporate sponsorships are a tool that's used to form a brand identity and brand image via increased visibility. While supporting a popular and socially conscious cause or individual may be mutually beneficial to both parties, a corporate sponsor is not a donation, it's a business deal. So corporate sponsors often characterize their sponsorship activities and their benefits as like, quote, doing well by doing good. The conventional wisdom is that a corporate sponsor facilitates a mental link between a brand and a popular event, program, project, or person, and customers. So the so-called halo effect, really. The best corporate sponsorships involve companies and sponsorees that have a link, such as a sports apparel manufacturer supporting a race. But sponsorships involving partners that have little relationship to one another can work well if the demographics match. Now, corporate sponsorship is common for programs like at museums or festivals or, in this case, skating events. But it's also seen in the commercial sphere, such as athlete endorsements. So, for example, an athletic facility may bear the name of a company and the name of a sporting competition may be preceded by the name of the sponsoring company. Now, the level of recommendation depends on the goals of the sponsor, and some companies may want to further a particular project or program without necessarily drawing public attention. But like when I lived in Denver, for example, the stadium there was called Sports Authority Field at Mile High, and it just sounds like a sponsorship until Sports Authority went under, and now they have another name. So, but sponsorships, basically, like in this case, he was a prominent skateboarder. So these skateboarding companies are coming to him, wanting him to more or less be the face of their brand because he was successful. He was young, charismatic. He was well known. So that's why like him receiving in today's money, $36,000 a month just on the sale of these decks. It's pretty impressive. Now, I remember when I was young and Tiger Woods got a $100 million endorsement deal from Nike. These are not something that's new, but it is something that kind of shows how these young athletes were making so much more money than just through their sport.
Right.
So what else can you tell me about him?
Rogowski was one of a group of elite skaters who enjoyed significant fame in the 1980s, alongside Christian Hosoi, Tony Hawk, Lance Mountain, and Steve Caballero. He was a charismatic, flamboyant personality who came during skateboarding's return to popularity following the success of vert skateboarding.
You mentioned vert skateboarding. What vert skateboarding is it's short for vertical skateboarding, and it's an act of riding a skateboard on a skate ramp or other incline that involves the skateboarder transitioning from the horizontal plane to the vertical plane in order to perform skateboarding tricks. Now, vert skateboarding has its genesis in pool riding, which was the riding of skateboards in an emptied backyard swimming pool. This was really popular during the 1970s. And as riders moved from general street skateboarding and occasional pool riding into purpose-built skate parks, vert skateboarding became much more popular. And skateboarders began to develop and then practice tricks and techniques specifically for this type of skateboarding. It became a very common style of skateboarding and was actually introduced into competitions like the X Games and the Maloof Money Cup. In 2008, ESPN and X Games organizers announced that vert skateboarding would be removed from X Game competitions in favor of free movement skate park style courses, where participants would still be able to perform vert skateboarding tricks, but would need to do so in combination with other street skateboarding elements. Now, there was a lot of public condemnation about this, and skateboarders Bob Burnquist, Tony Hawk, and several others, they really came out against this, and so the organizers reinstated it. However, in 2011, ESPN announced that the X Games would no longer feature a woman's vert skateboarding event, citing a lack of growing participation base, an established annual competition schedule, and a myriad of other factors. Now, Lindsay Adam Hawkins, who's a professional skateboarder, said the decision would basically end the growth for women's vert skating as we know it. A real nice way to think of vert skating is kind of like the old big half pipes that, you know, you'd see skateboarders skating in. It's just so that they can transition from the horizontal to vertical plane. So really, I mean, compared to what we see nowadays, I'm not going to say it's limited because I am not a skateboarder in any way, shape, or form. That said, were you a skateboarder in your youth or your currentness?
I tried for like maybe 2 minutes when I was a small child and quickly learned that I am not graceful and should not be. I have no business being on a skateboard. So that kind of ended that interest for me.
I remember being able to sit on it and go down a hill, and yes, that was the extent of it. However, I will say that one of my younger brothers, John David Hudson, was a very talented young skateboarder. He really took a shine to it. We actually thought that he might go professional at some point, but that didn't happen. But he was incredibly talented. I remember watching him and thinking I would break my ankles just thinking of it. So, I mean, these guys are incredible athletes. It's incredible to see.
Definitely, yeah.
I'm getting the feeling that maybe Rogowski wasn't all sunshine and roses.
No. In 1986, Rogowski was detained by police in Virginia Beach, Virginia, after assaulting an officer in the parking lot of Mount Trashmore Park during the East Coast Assault Pro Contest. At a 1987 skate show in Scottsdale, Arizona, Rogowski was introduced to Brandy McLean and her good friend Jessica Bergson, an aspiring model. Soon after, he began a tumultuous long-term relationship with McLean. They appeared together in numerous advertisements and promotional videos for Vision, which had become one of the top-selling skateboarding brands of the 1980s. In late 1988, Rogowski was featured on the Swatch Impact Tour, of 35 tour dates across the United States, which also showcased fellow pro skaters Jeff Phillips, Kevin Staub, Chris Miller, and Joe Johnson. In 1989, Rogowski also worked as a stunt double on the 1989 film Gleaming the Cube, which starred Christian Slater, and appeared along with McLean in the music video for Free Fallen by Tom Petty. As vert skating, popular in the 1980s, was supplanted by street skateboarding in the 1990s, Rogowski's popularity declined. Vision, the company he was with for the majority of his career, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. For reinvention, Rogowski changed his name to Gator Mark Anthony, explaining that Rogowski was the name of the father he never knew.
So you mentioned street skateboarding. Now, to give context as to what the difference is, street skateboarding is a skateboarding discipline which focuses on flat ground tricks, grinds, slides, and aerials within urban environments and public spaces. Now, street skateboarders meet, skate, and hang out in and around urban areas referred to as spots, which are commonly streets, plazas, or industrial areas. To add variety and complexity to street skateboarding, obstacles such as handrails, stairs, walls, flower beds, bins, park benches, picnic tables, and other street furniture may be traversed as single tricks or as part of a series of consecutive tricks called a line. Now, during the late 1980s and early 1990s, street skateboarding evolved as a new approach to skateboarding, using elements taken from other existing skateboarding disciplines. Instead of drained swimming pools and purpose-built skate parks, skateboarders began to use urban areas and public spaces. For example, in the 1980s, Philadelphia's Love Park transformed from a place where business people would eat their lunch into a well-known skateboarding spot. A new style of skateboard deck, which had a kicktail at each end, became popular, and professional skateboarding became hyper-commercialized, and skate shops specializing in the retail of professional-grade skateboarding equipment appeared in many cities across the world. Skate shops, in return, helped support a culture of street skateboarding by offering skateboarders a refuge where they could check out and buy copies of the latest skate videos. For those of us older individuals, those would have been on VHS tapes, later DVDs. They could also get magazines and other skateboarding products there. Many street skaters abandoned skate parks entirely in favor of public and urban areas, and street skaters began to observe architecture and look for skatable obstacles. This has kind of been a two-edged sword. It's great that people are going out and doing this. There have been a lot of complaints about it as well, and destruction of property. So I think there's kind of a lot to be said on both on that. Now, when discussing street skating, however, this is a completely different thing, and I can tell you that I was absolutely amazing at street skating on my PlayStation with the Tony Hawk game. So I think just about everybody knew about that game. Most people probably played it a little bit here and there. It was a lot of fun. I remember, again, seeing a lot of my friends who then all of a sudden thought that they could do such things, and many a broken arm and ankle was known in those years for that. Did you play that at all by any chance, Rebel?
You know, I missed out on that. I was too busy playing other video games, I guess, racing and whatnot, so I never played the skateboarding games.
You know, I think you can be forgiven for that. I mentioned Tony Hawk, but his wasn't the best skateboarding game. Bart Simpson's skateboarding was by far superior.
Of course.
And I think everybody can agree with that. So after his rebranding, what happened to him?
So after a severe accident in West Germany, where Rogowski either fell or was pushed from a hotel window and landed on a fence, he returned home to Carlsbad to recover. After befriending Augie Constantino, an ex-surfer turned born-again Christian who also became his spiritual advisor, Rogowski converted to a strict evangelical form of Christianity, influencing his attitude and skateboard deck designs. After 4 years of dating McLean, Rogowski suggested the couple marry, proclaiming that they, quote, can't have sex anymore unless we get married. The sudden lifestyle change contributed to the end of McLean's relationship with Rogowski, along with his occasional bouts of violence, which included his locking her in a closet, and unprovoked jealousy, and she returned to her parents' home in San Diego, California. Rogowski began a period of severe alcoholism following McLean's departure. Following the end of his relationship with McLean, Rogowski was jealous. He entered her home to steal gifts he had given her. He made threatening telephone calls to McLean's new boyfriend, and he also threatened McLean directly. McLean informed police about Rogowski's behavior. They filed a report, but the situation was not monitored continuously.
This is taking place in California in the early 90s, 1990, I believe. This is clearly stalking. And stalking is something that we have discussed several times on this podcast. I think the most recent one was probably during the Christy Richardson's case. We talked about it there as well. Rebel, you gave us some insight into your experiences with it as well. Now, the thing with stalking, especially at this time, is in most U.S. states, while it was understood what it was, there were no actual laws against it. California, however, is the exception. So in 1990, becoming suddenly conscious of the inadequacies of current law, the California legislature actually responded by creating the nation's first stalking law. It is the statute that criminalizes the repeated harassment or following of another person in conjunction with a threat. Currently, California aggressively enforces that law. as they should. But at this point, we can see that they aren't. And this is something that we see a lot with new laws, that they're not often sure how to implement them. But this is a case here where he's literally breaking and entering. He's stealing. That's burglary. He's making threatening phone calls to her and to her boyfriend. They file the report. They inform the police. And I know this is going to be shocking to our listeners, but the police didn't do anything with it. Mm-hmm. He's not arrested. He's not detained. There's no surveillance set up. It's just kind of a situation. I feel, not to beat a dead horse, because we do this a lot, we go over some of the same things, but there are patterns in these cases that you can see. Like, there are often moments where you can see, okay, this is where it could have been stopped. And I think that this is one of those moments.
Right.
After the police do not do their due diligence, what happens?
So on March 20th, 1991, Rogowski talked with 22-year-old Bergston for the first time in years. Bergston asked Rogowski to show her around San Diego. They spent a day together on March 21st, 1991, shortly after Bergston was reported missing. According to Rogowski, he and Bergston went back to his condo to watch movies, smoke weed, and drink wine. He admitted to coming up behind her and hitting her in the head with a club, which is a metal auto anti-theft device. After knocking her semi-unconscious by way of several strikes, he handcuffed her and dragged her to his bedroom on the second floor and raped her while she was shackled to his bed. Afterward, he placed her in a surfboard bag because he was concerned about the neighbors hearing the noise. Rogowski placed his hand over Bergston's mouth until she stopped breathing, then drove the body to the Shell Canyon Desert and disposed of the corpse in a shallow grave. Bergston's body was found by campers on April 10, 1991, but it was so decomposed it could not be identified. Plagued by guilt, Rogowski informed Constantino, "Remember that girl from the poster? She was the one I killed." Constantino encouraged Rogowski to confess his crime to the police, which he subsequently did. Rogowski turned himself in on April 11, 1991, and led police to the grave of Bergston's body. Police searched his home and found evidence of blood soaked through the carpet, padding, and into the floorboards in two small spots adjacent to where Bergston's head allegedly rests. In his confession, Rogowski conveyed that he had killed Bergston in a misplaced act of revenge for Ford McLean, calling Bergston the, quote, mold brandy was made out of. Entering prison, Rogowski was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Rogowski was charged with special circumstances, committing a murder during rape. Under California law, this warrants the death penalty or life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. His lawyer, John Jimenez, challenged the validity and content of the confession. Jimenez appealed the rape charge, insisting the decomposed body showed no signs of forcible rape, but the appeal was eventually dismissed.
All right, so you mentioned special circumstances. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the special circumstance in this, which was committing murder during rape. What special circumstances are? It's in criminal cases, particularly homicides, actions of the accused or the situation under which the crime was committed, for which state statutes allow or require imposition of a more severe punishment. In this case, as you said, life imprisonment without parole or the death penalty. That's California specific. So there are actually 22 listed special circumstances that can be applied if the defendant is convicted of first-degree murder in the state of California. The only penalties that are possible in those cases are life imprisonment without parole or death, unless you're a juvenile, and then it's 25 years to life. California, as of March 2019, has placed a moratorium on capital punishment. So the death penalty is no longer there on that, but it would be life in prison without parole. Now, there is one other state in the U.S. that has this, and that's Connecticut. And there are 8 ways to be convicted of murder with special circumstances, and all of them mandate life in prison without the possibility of parole. So at this point, those are the only two options that he has. I'm going to point out again the irony of him stating to his girlfriend that they have to get married because they can no longer have sex outside of marriage. and instead he chooses to handcuff and rape this other woman.
Right.
It's insane. I understand that he is diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Lots of people are. I'm also going to take... It's absolutely not an excuse. And I'm also going to say that his lawyer challenging or appealing, I guess, the rape charge, saying that this decomposed body can't show signs of forcible rape is... It's almost disgusting to me. The family members of this victim are being shown absolutely no consideration. Now, I understand that it's his job as his defense attorney to try and represent his client and get him as good a deal or as good a shake as he possibly can. But for me, that's just, it's wrong. It feels very, very wrong to me to try and say this, especially again, after there has already been a confession made. So challenging the validity and the content of the confession, defense lawyers do that all the time. I get it. But demanding that a corpse that's decomposing in the California heat to show signs of forcible rape, it's a lot. I don't know. What are your feelings on reading this, the crime itself and the subsequent defense that this attorney's making?
Yeah, it's real slimy. I think I can't imagine what the family goes through when it's not even, you know, Rogowski didn't, he admitted to it. So it's not a matter of him, you know, saying, I didn't do this, but the lawyer is trying to appeal it and say, oh, it didn't happen now. Like, no.
Yeah, you and I are of one mind on this. This is a lot. I mean, there's a reason that, you know, lawyers kind of have the reputation they do in the States and how they're seen. Mm-hmm. And I think this is just kind of a perfect example moment.
Yeah.
So what ended up happening to Rogowski?
Following the advice of his attorney, Rogowski pled guilty to first-degree murder and rape, thus avoiding the death penalty or life without the chance of parole. In January 1992, at the plea hearing, Gator submitted a 4-page written statement. He accepted responsibility for his acts, accepted responsibility for sexual activities outside of marriage, for his promiscuity, and for not following the word of the Bible. Rogowski was sentenced on March 6, 1992. 5 uniformed bailiffs with metal detectors were at the hearing due to a rumor that Stephen Bergston, the father of the victim, would attempt to harm Rogowski. Bergston lost 2 properties due to his involvement with a nationwide drug ring, and he allegedly had nothing to lose by harming Rogowski. With the bailiffs standing between Rogowski and Bergston, Rogowski offered an apology while Bergston shouted back that he, quote, was a coward who would die 1,000 deaths. Rogowski received a 31-year-to-life prison sentence, 6 years for forcible rape, and 25 years to life for the first-degree murder charge to be served consecutively.
All right, so a couple things to dive into on this, but first and foremost, you said that these were to be served consecutively, which is why we come to the 31-year-to-life sentence. So in the U.S., you can have your sentences, if you're convicted of multiple crimes, be served concurrently or consecutively. In this case, it's consecutive, so we take the 6 and the 25, add them together, 31 years to life. In some cases, they're served concurrently, so in that case, it would be 25 years to life, and he's serving the 6 years for rape at the same time as he's serving the 25 years to life. It's really all up to the sentencing judge. There's not a whole lot of, there's not a scale that you could say happens. So I'm going to go further on this. We see that Gator submitted a 4-page written statement, right? And I am a person of faith myself, but I feel, as I researched this case, that this was simply a ploy for sympathy. He takes responsibility for his promiscuity. To me, that's not what this is. This is not you being promiscuous. This is you being a predator. There's a very important distinction. And for not following the word of the Bible, like, this is not the time for you to wax religious all of a sudden. Like, that time has long passed. And sexual activities outside of marriage, like, these are not the things he needs to be apologizing for. Like, right. He assaulted this girl, he raped this girl, he murdered this girl. Saying, oh, well, yeah, I'm really sorry that I had sex outside of marriage and that I wasn't, you know, faithful to purity culture, and I should have stayed truer to the word of God. Yeah, you probably should have, but it's that ship has sailed and passed. And this guy, the more that I researched him, the less and less sincere I felt about every word that he said. So I don't know. I'm going to ask for you on this, because you and I are not necessarily of the same mind in some of these situations. How does this feel to you?
Yeah, it's Rogowski was not a good person by any means. And to start talking about religion and to talk about his promiscuity and whatnot, it just feels like injustice for the victim, because he obviously didn't care in that moment, and he made the conscious decision to do what he did and was not a forward-thinking Christian while he did it.
I would agree. I also feel that, you know, he said he felt guilty, but he felt guilty after they found the body, after the fact.
Right.
Like, it's not like he did this, went, oh no, called the police, turned himself in immediately. I felt that this was more self-preservation than true remorse.
I agree.
So after that, he's sentenced. I know that he has been up for parole. So how has that worked out for him?
So Rogowski was denied parole on February 7th, 2011. Deputy District Attorney Richard Sachs argued that Rogowski remains a, quote, unreasonable risk to society and should remain in prison, while a family member of Bergston also attended the hearing and requested Rogowski remain incarcerated. On February 6, 2015, another parole hearing was scheduled, but Rogowski waived his right to a hearing for 1 year. On March 9, 2016, he was again denied parole for 7 years. On December 10, 2019, multiple media reports indicated that Rogowski's parole board recommended parole. The California Board of Parole Hearings finalized the decision, and the case went before the California Governor's staff for review. On April 27, 2020, Rogowski's parole grant was reversed by Governor Gavin Newsom, stating Rogowski needed to gain a, quote, deeper understanding of his crimes. In June 2022, a San Diego County Parole Board granted Rogowski parole, with his attorney citing the parole board's trained psychologist found him to be a low risk of danger to the public. This was to be followed by a 120-day review period by the board, and then up to 30 days for the governor to make a final decision. District Attorney Summer Steffen asked Governor Gavin Newsom to deny parole for Mark Gator Rogowski after the parole board panel found him suitable for release. In a statement, Steffen said family and friends of 22-year-old Jessica Bergston deserved the continued promise of justice in this case. Our office argued strongly against releasing this violent defendant, she said. Rogowski's attorney, Laura Shepard, said in a statement that her client is remorseful and, quote, devastated by the impact of his crime. My position, of course, is that there is no current evidence that Mark remains dangerous, Shepard said. In fact, I think the governor should be proud of the success the California prison system has had in rehabilitating Mark. She added that the system, quote, succeeded, and Mark's good behavior in prison, sincere remorse, and track record of making amends are proof that it works. Governor Gavin Newsom again reversed the parole board's decision, ensuring Rogowski would continue to serve his sentence. Rogowski has another parole board hearing scheduled for December of 2024. And as of November 2023, Rogowski is incarcerated at Donovan State Prison.
All right. We're going to have our closing thoughts on this, and I really would like to hear yours as well. So my thought on this, I am all about, you know, rehabilitation and redemption. I think that the prison system in the U.S. is filled to capacity. I think that we have way too many convicts in our prisons. That said, I think there is a lot to be said for justice for this family that is ongoing. I understand now that the parole boards have twice said that he's ready to be released, and twice the governor's office has said no. They have their reasons for that. The district attorney is going to do what they can to ensure that they don't have repeat violent offenders. I can't speak to whether or not Rogowski would be a danger at this point to anyone. But I know that he was a danger to a 22-year-old girl, and that her family will never, ever see her again. And that he pled his way out of the sentence that I believe he deserved. And not just the sentence that I believe he deserved, the sentence that the state of California has put forward. By his own confession, he murdered this girl and he raped this girl. And under the special circumstances laws, that's enough for a life in prison with no possibility of parole. So that's my thought on it. If he spends the rest of his life in jail, I'm not going to shed tears for it. The things that he did were absolutely brutal. And to be honest, they were a bit dumbed down for this podcast. It researched the case a bit yourself, dear listeners, and I think you'll understand a bit more as to why I feel the way I do about this. It was an absolutely brutal and shocking thing to read. So I think I'm going to leave my closing thoughts there, and I'm going to ask you, Rebel, what are your closing thoughts on this case?
I am very much in agreement. I think that what he did was a senseless, brutal crime that he committed. He willfully acknowledged that he did so, and I think that he should serve life in prison. It doesn't make up for what he did. Like you said, there's still a woman that lost her life at a very young age, and her family misses her and didn't get to see her. She didn't get to live a full life, and he doesn't deserve to either.
I agree. Not only that, but the last, moments of that poor girl's life were just absolutely horrendous as well. Like, from exactly. The handcuffing, the assault, being stuffed into a bag, like, the list goes on and on. And again, we've said it all before, but I'm glad that we're in agreement on this. He just, to me, the punishment should fit the crime. And this is not a case of wrongful conviction. So let him serve his sentence as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. Yep.
Now that we have absolutely let our dear listeners know exactly how we feel about this, I believe it is time for our missing person of the week.
Yes.
So who do you have for us this week, Rebel?
So this week's missing person case focuses on Tawana Jean Ego. Tawana was born April 10th, 1978. She was 44 when she went missing and is 45 now. Tawana was last seen November 23rd, 2022 in Mico, Florida, near 8300 Woods Trail. She abruptly stopped going to places she frequented and has not been in contact with friends or family. Tawana is 5'2" to 5'4" tall and 100 to 110 pounds. She has shoulder-length brown hair and brown eyes. She has two moles above her upper lip and visible needle marks on both arms. It is unknown what she was last seen wearing. Although Tawana is homeless and has a history of drug use, she is known to be habitual in her contact with loved ones, as well as with spending time in the area. An acquaintance of Tawana reportedly saw her at a Walmart store in Sebastian, Florida, in November 2022. She was with a man who had blonde hair and a beard, but seemed to appear anxious, unlike her normal outgoing personality. She also had a bruise on her face or head. While there are rumors of possible foul play, nothing has been substantiated and no further sightings have been reported. She may still be in the Florida area and living among the homeless population. If you have any information about Tawana Ego, please contact the Brevard County Sheriff's Office at 321-633-8419 using case number 2023 0018-001-98517.
So this one for me pulls at my heartstrings. This woman is homeless. She's already got it badly enough. She's already living a pretty rough life. But she was also always bubbly and friendly and nice. It would be nice to find out if she's still okay. Yeah. Having her friends see her with someone, seeing her bruised, seeing her nervous and anxious, it doesn't make you feel good about the case. And as we've touched on before, you know, in cases of people who are habitual drug users or homeless, oftentimes they go missing and they just stay missing. They're not looked for as much as they should. So hopefully someone out there hears this and they know something, or they've seen something, or maybe they've seen her. If so, please use the numbers that Rebel has given, or as always, Crime Stoppers is there for you to talk to anonymously. It's a great resource, so please use it if you can.
Definitely.
Well, Rebel, I think that I've had about as much as I can take for 1 week.
Yeah, me too.
This case was a hard one. But
yeah.
Let's say that we have listeners out there that want to share this hard case with their friends and family. Where should they send them?
So we're hosted on Podbean, as well as most of the other major podcast hosting sites. So Apple, Spotify, Amazon, etc. We can be found on social media as Murderosity or Murderosity Podcast. We post our show notes at murderosity.com. And if you have any tips or questions or anything that you want to shoot us a line for, you can email us at murderosity@gmail.com.
And we do love getting those lines dropped. As mentioned earlier, we love getting tips and cases from everybody. We have a lot coming down that have all been suggested by you, our dear listeners. So
yes, if you haven't heard the case that you're looking for yet, you can either suggest it if it hasn't been suggested, or if you've already suggested it, then we are probably working on it in the future.
These do take a bit to produce and edit and get ready, but it's a labor of love, and we do appreciate it. And truly, if you disagree with something we say on our podcast, we're more than happy to have that open dialogue as well. So
exactly.
Thank you very much for spending the last bit of your time with us, but I think that's going to do it for me.
Yes, me too.
All right. Well, thank you again, and we'll catch you on the next one.
All right. Stay safe out there.